Side 5, Time's Eye, by Arthur C. Clarke and Stephen Baxter. Continuing on page 180. Now the discussion turned to the meaning of what had happened to them all. How history could have been chopped up into pieces, and why. The Macedonians did not seem as awestruck as Bessessa had naively imagined. They had absolutely no doubt that the time slips were the work of the gods, following their own inscrutable purposes. Their worldview, which had nothing to do with science, was alien to Bessessa's, but it was easily flexible enough to accommodate such mysteries as this. They were tough-minded warriors who had marched thousands of kilometers into strangeness, and they and their Greek advisers were intellectually tough, too. Alexander himself seemed entranced by the philosophical aspects.
"Can the dead live again?" he murmured in his throaty baritone. "For I am long dead to you. And can the past be restored? Old wrongs undone? Regrets wiped away?"
Abdikadir murmured to Bessessa,
"A man with as much blood on his hands as this king must find the notion of correcting the past appealing."
Hephaestion was saying,
"Most philosophers view time as a cycle, like the beating of a heart, the passing of the seasons, the waxing and waning of the moon. In Babylon, the astronomers assembled a cosmic calendar based on the motions of the planets, with a great year that lasts, I believe, more than 400,000 years. When the planets congregate in one particular constellation, there is a huge fire, and the winter, marked by a planetary gathering elsewhere, marked by a flood. Some even argue that past events repeat exactly from one cycle to the next."
"But that notion troubled Aristotle," said Alexander,
who, Bessessa recalled, had actually studied under that philosopher.
"If I live as much before the fall of Troy as after it, then what caused that war?"
"But still," Hephaestion said, "if there is something in the notion of cycles, then many strange things can be justified. For instance, oracles and prophets. If time cycles, perhaps prophecy is as much a question of a memory of the deep past as it is a vision of the future. And the strange mixing of times we endure now seems much less inexplicable. Do you agree, Aristander?"
The old seer bowed his head. So the conversation continued, rattling between Alexander, Hephaestion, and Aristander, often too rapidly for the creaky chain of translators to keep up. Ruddy was entranced.
"How marvelous these men are," he whispered.
"Enough philosophy," said Eumenes, practical as ever. He challenged the meeting about what they should do next. Captain Grove replied that he had a proposal. The British officer had brought along an atlas, a rather antiquated thing, even by his standards, from a Victorian schoolroom, and he now displayed it. The Macedonians were familiar with maps and map-making. Indeed, throughout his campaigns, Alexander had brought along Greek surveyors and draftsmen to map the lands he explored and conquered, many of them barely known to the ancient Greek world he came from. So the Macedonians were intrigued by the atlas and crowded around the little book excitedly. They were intrigued by the quality of the printing, the regularity of the type and the page's bright coloring. The Macedonians seemed to have little trouble accepting that the Mediterranean-centered world they knew was only a section of the planet, and that the planet was a sphere, as predicted by Pythagoras centuries before Alexander's time. In fact, Aristotle, Alexander's tutor, had written a whole book about the notion. For her part, Bessessa was amused by the great swaths inked in pink to show the territories of the British Empire at its zenith. At last, Alexander, in some exasperation, demanded that the atlas be brought up to his throne. But he was dismayed when the outline of his empire was sketched on a whole earth map.
"I thought I had made a mighty footprint on the world, but there is so much I never even saw," he said.
Using the atlas, Captain Groves said that his proposal was that the forces, combined, should make for Babylon. Abdikadir tried to explain about the radio signals picked up by the Soyuz. This was predictably baffling, until Ruddy and Josh hit on happy metaphors.
"Like the sound of inaudible trumpets," Ruddy said, "or the flash of invisible mirrors."
Abdikadir said, "And the only signal we have found came from here."
He pointed to Babylon.
That is surely our best chance of determining what has happened to us and to the world. All this was transmitted to Alexander.
Babylon struck chords with the Macedonians, too. There had been no news from Macedon or anywhere else beyond the Indus Valley for many days now. And nor had the British received any messages from their own time. There was the question of where they should settle if no news was forthcoming. Alexander had always planned to make Babylon a capital of an empire that might have stretched from the Mediterranean to India, united by sea and river routes. Perhaps even now that dream might be achievable, even with the resources the king had at hand, even if the rest of the world he had known had vanished. For all these reasons, the best path seemed clear. As the consensus emerged, Ruddy was thrilled.
Babylon, by God, where will this adventure not take us?
The meeting quickly got down to detailed questions of timetables and logistics. The light beyond the tent grew dimmer, circulating servants brought more wine, and the assembly slowly grew more raucous. When they could get away from the Macedonians, Josh, Abdelkadir, Ruddy, and Bessessa gathered. Bessessa said, "We'll have to leave something for Sable and Kolya in case they ever make it here." They discussed markers such as big stone arrows on the ground, cairns with messages, even leaving radios for the stranded cosmonauts.
"And are you happy," said Abdelkadir, "that we are throwing in our lot with Alexander and his crew?"
"Yes," said Ruddy immediately. "Aristotle taught these fellows openness of mind and heart, and a curiosity about the world. Alexander's journey was as much an exploration as an expedition of conquest."
"Captain Cook with a 50,000-man army," Abdelkadir mused.
"And surely," Ruddy said, "it was this very openness that enabled them to accept the customs of unfamiliar peoples, and so to weld an empire that, if not for the untimely death of Alexander, might have endured for centuries, an advanced civilization by 1,000 years.
"But here," Josh said, "Alexander isn't dead."
The assessor was aware that Alexander was watching them. He leaned back and murmured something to the eunuch, and she wondered if he had heard what they said. But he finished,
"I can think of no finer legacy than to have established a British empire in Asia and Europe 2,000 years or more before its time."
"But Alexander's empire," Josh said, "had nothing to do with democracy or Greek values. He committed atrocities. He burned Persepolis, for instance. He paid for each section of his endless campaign with the loot from the last. And he spent lives like matches, perhaps 750,000 by some estimates."
"He was a man of his time," said Ruddy, stern and cynical as if he were twice his age. "What can you expect? In his world, order derived only from empire. Within the empire's borders, you had culture, order, a chance at civilization. Outside, there were only barbarians and chaos. There was no other way to run things. And his achievement endured, even if his empire did not. He spread the Greek language from Alexandria to Syria like jam over toast. When the Romans pushed east, they found not barbarians, but Greek speakers. If not for that Greek legacy, Christianity would have had a hard time spreading out of Judea."
"Perhaps," Abdelkadir said, grinning. "But, Kipling, I'm not a Christian."
Captain Grove joined them.
"I suspect our business is done," he said quietly. "I'm jolly pleased we came to such a quick agreement. And it's remarkable how much we hold in common. I suppose nothing fundamental has changed in 2,000 years when it comes to carting an army around the place. But look here. I think the gathering is starting to degenerate a bit. I've heard about Alexander and his debaucheries," he said with a rueful grin. "And much as I'd rather give it a miss, I fear it would be politic of me to stick around and do a little getting to know you with these chaps. Don't worry, I can handle my wine. My lads will stay on too. But if you want to slip away..."
Bessessa accepted the excuse. Ruddy and Josh agreed to leave too, though Ruddy looked back with envy at the shimmering interior of the royal tent, where a curvaceous young woman dressed only in a floor-length veil was starting to dance. Outside the tent, Bessessa found Philip, Alexander's Greek doctor, waiting for her. Bessessa hastily summoned De Morgan. The factor was half drunk already, but able to translate. Philip said,
"The king knows you spoke of his death."
"Ah, I'm sorry. And he wants you to tell him how he will die."
Bessessa hesitated.
"We have a legend, a tale of what happened to him."
"He will die soon," Philip breathed. Yes, he would have. Where? She hesitated again. Babylon. Then he will die young, like Achilles, his hero. That's just like Alexander.
Philip glanced back at the king's tent, where, judging from the noise, the debauch was gathering steam. He looked troubled but resigned. Well, it's no surprise. He drinks as he fights, enough for 10 men. And he was nearly killed by an arrow in his lung. I fear he will not allow himself time to recover, but...
He won't listen to his doctor?
Philip smiled.
Some things never change.
Vicessa made a quick decision. She dug into her survival pack under her jumpsuit and pulled out a plastic sheet of malaria tablets. She showed Philip how to pop the pills out of their bubbles.
Have your king take these, she said. Nobody knows for sure how it happened. The truth was obscured by rumor, conflict, and false history. But some believe it will be of the sickness these tablets will prevent.
Philip frowned. Why do you give me these?
Because I think your king is going to be important for all our futures. If he dies, at least it won't be this way.
Philip closed his hand over the sheet of tablets and smiled. Thank you, lady. But tell me... Yes? Will they remember him in the future? Again, the strange dilemma of too much knowledge, compounded for Bessessa by long sessions with her phone as she had researched Alexander's story.
Yes, they even remember his horse.
Bucephalus had died in a battle on the river Jhelum.
More than 1,000 years from now, in the land beyond the Oxus, the rulers will claim that their horses once all had horns on their heads and were descended from Bucephalus when Alexander passed there.
Philip was enchanted. Alexander had a headdress with golden horns made for Bucephalus in battle. Lady, if the king is ever close to death,
tell him then.
When he had gone, she turned on De Morgan.
And you keep that to yourself.
He spread his hands.
Of course, we must keep Alexander alive. If we are stuck here, he may indeed be our best hope of salvaging something of our future. But by all the gods, Bessessa, why not sell those pills to him? Alexander is 1,000 times richer than any other man of his time. What a waste.
Laughing, she walked away. 24. The Hunt. At last, the battue was ready. An enormous area of the steppe had been designated for the hunt, which was run as a military exercise. Army units were deployed in a great cordon, each with a full general in command. The beaters closed in toward the center, moving as if on maneuvers, with scouts in advance of the main body of troops, and flanking sections to either side. Trumpets and flags were used to communicate around this mass of troops. And once it was closed, the circle was maintained with great precision. When the beating began, Genghis Khan himself led the imperial procession to a low ridge, which would serve as a good viewpoint. All the golden family were required to be present, along with Genghis's wives and concubines, chamberlains and servants. Yelü traveled with the royal party and brought Kolya, Sable and their interpreters with him. The scale of the exercise was startling. When he took his place at the summit of the ridge, Kolya could see only a couple of military units drawn up in formation, standards flying, horses restless on the plain below. The rest were somewhere over the horizon. And he was stunned by the opulence of the food, drink, and other hospitality laid on for the royal party. While they waited for the beating to be completed, the golden family were kept amused by falconry displays. One man brought forward a mighty eagle perched on a massive hawking glove. When the bird stretched its wings, their span was wider than the keeper was tall. A lamb was released, and the bird lunged with a ferocity that dragged the keeper off his feet to the hilarity of the royal party. The falconry was followed by horse races. Mongol races were conducted over kilometers, and only the finishing stages were visible from Kolya's position. The child jockeys, surely no older than 7 or 8, rode their full-sized mounts bareback and barefoot. The riding was ferocious, and the finishers, masked by a billowing cloud of dust, were close. The golden family threw gold and jewels at the victors. As far as Kolya was concerned, all this was another example of the Mongols' mixture of barbarity and vulgar ostentation. Or, as Sable put it, these people really don't have any taste. But Kolya could not deny the calm aura of Genghis Khan himself. Militarily disciplined, politically astute, single-minded and incorruptible, Genghis Khan had been born the son of a clan chief. He was called Temujin, which meant Smith. His adopted name meant Universal Ruler. It took a decade of fratricidal conflict for Temujin to unite the Mongols into a single nation for the first time in generations, and he became the ruler of all tribes who live in felt tents. Mongol armies consisted almost entirely of cavalry, highly mobile, disciplined, and fast-moving. Their fighting style had been honed over generations in hunting and warring across the plains. For the sedentary nations of farms and cities around the fringe of the steppe, the Mongols were difficult neighbors, but they weren't exceptional. For centuries, the great land ocean of Asia had spawned armies of marauding horsemen. The Mongols were just the latest in that long and bloody tradition. But under Genghis Khan, they became a fury. Genghis Khan began his campaigns against the three nations of China. Rapidly growing rich on plunder, the Mongols next turned west, assailing Khwarezm, a rich and ancient Islamic state that stretched from Iran to the Caspian Sea. After that, the Mongols pushed on through the Caucasus into the Ukraine and Crimea, and struck north in an outrageous raid on Russia. By the time of Genghis Khan's death, his empire, built in a single generation, was already four times as extensive as Alexander's, and twice as large as Rome's ever became. But Genghis Khan remained a barbarian. His only purpose, the empowerment and enrichment of his golden family. And the Mongols were killers. Their ruthlessness derived from their own traditions. Illiterate nomads, they saw no purpose in agriculture, no value in cities, save as mines of plunder. And they placed no value on human life. This was the creed applied to each conquest. Now, Kolya had been magically transported to the heart of the Mongol Empire itself. Here, the benefits of the empire were more apparent than in history books written by descendants of the vanquished. For the first time in history, Asia had been united from the boundaries of Europe to the South China Sea. The tapestries that adorned Genghis's tents combined Chinese dragon designs with Iranian phoenixes. Though contact would be lost after the Mongols' empire decayed, myths of Eastern nations were replaced by memory. A memory that would one day inspire Christopher Columbus to strike out across the Atlantic Ocean, seeking a new route to Cathay. But in the overrun lands, the suffering was vast. Ancient cities were erased, whole populations slaughtered. Compared to the human misery Kolya was able to perceive, even in the pavilion of Genghis Khan himself, the benefits of the empire seemed of little worth indeed. But Sable, he saw clearly, was drawn to the Mongols' rapacious glamour. At last the beating troops appeared over the horizon, yelling and crying, and converged on the hunting ground. Runners stretched ropes between the army groups, making a cordon. Cornered animals lumbered or raced to and fro, dimly visible in the great cloud of dust they raised. Kolya peered into the dust clouds.
I wonder what they've caught. I see horses, asses maybe, wolves, hyenas, foxes, camels, hares. They are all terrified.
Sable pointed.
Look over there.
A larger shape loomed through the dust. It was like a great boulder, Kolya thought at first, a thing of the earth, much taller than a human being. But it moved massively, immense shoulders working, and curtains of rust-brown hair shimmered. When it raised its head, he saw a curling trunk, spiral tusks, and he heard a peal like a Bach trumpet.
A mammoth, he breathed. Genghis's hunters, crossing the time slips, have trapped more than they bargained for. It is the dream of ages to witness this, if only we had a camera.
But Sable was indifferent. A little stiffly, Genghis Khan mounted his horse. He rode forward with a couple of guards to either side. It was his privilege to make the first kill. He took position not 20 meters below Kolya and waited for the prey to be shepherded to him. Suddenly there were screams. Some of Genghis' guards broke ranks and fled, despite the howls of their commanders. Through the billowing dust before Genghis, Kolya saw a red rag flung through the air. No, not a rag. It was a human being, a Mongol warrior, his chest ripped open, entrails dangling. Genghis Khan held his ground, holding his horse steady, his lance and scimitar raised. Kolya saw the beast coming, emerging from the dust. It was like a lion in its stealthy advance, but it was massively muscled, its shoulders more like a bear's. And when it opened its mouth, it revealed teeth that curved like Genghis Khan's scimitar. In a moment of deadly stillness, Emperor and saber-toothed cat faced each other. Then a single shot rang out, as unexpected as a clap of thunder from a clear sky. It was so close to Collier, his ears rang, and he heard the hiss of the bullet as it flew. Around Collier, the royal party and their attendants screamed and quailed. Suddenly the cat lay in the dirt, its hind legs twitching, its head exploded to a bloody mass. Genghis's horse was shying, but the Emperor had not flinched. It had been Sable, of course, but she had already hidden the pistol. Sable spread her arms.
Tengri, I am the emissary of heaven, sent to save you, great one, for you are intended to live forever and to rule all the world.
She turned to a whimpering Basil. In broken French, she hissed,
Translate, you dog, or it will be your head I take off next.
Genghis Khan stared up at her. The slaughter of the animals inside the cordon took days. It was customary for some of the animals to be let loose, but on this occasion, as Genghis's life had been threatened, none was allowed to live. Collier inspected the remains curiously. The heads and tusks of several mammoths were presented to Genghis, along with the pride of lions of a size nobody had seen before, and foxes with coats of a beautiful snowy whiteness. And there were a strange kind of people, too, caught up in the Mongols' net. Naked, fast-running, but unable to escape, they were a small family, a man, woman, and boy. The man was dispatched immediately, and the woman and child brought in chains to the royal household. The creatures were naked and filthy and seemed to have no speech. The woman was given to the soldiers for their sport, and the child was kept in a cage for a few days. Without his parents, the child would not eat and rapidly weakened. Collier saw him up close just once. Squatting on the ground inside his cage, the boy was tall, taller than all the Mongols, even taller than Collier. But his face and body had the unformed look of a child. His skin was weather-beaten and his feet were calloused. There wasn't an ounce of fat on his body, but his muscles were hard. He looked as if he could run all day without a break. Over his eyes was a heavy ridge of bone. When he looked at Collier, his eyes were startling blue, clear as the sky. There was intelligence there, Collier thought, but it wasn't a human intelligence. It was a blank knowingness, without a center in self, like the eyes of a lion. Collier tried to talk about this with Sable. Perhaps this was some pre-human, a Homo erectus, perhaps, haplessly caught up in the discontinuity. But Sable was nowhere to be found. When Collier went back, the cage had gone. He learned the boy had died, his body removed and burned with the rest of the waste from the hunt. Sable reappeared about noon the day after that. Edu and Collier were in the middle of another of their strategy sessions. Sable was wearing a Mongol tunic of the expensive embroidered sort the Golden Family sported, but she had bits of bright orange parachute silk in her hair and around her neck, a badge of her different origins. She looked wild, a creature neither of one world nor the other, out of control. Elu sat back and watched her steadily, wary, calculating.
What happened to you? Collier said in English. I haven't seen you since you pulled that gun.
Spectacular, wasn't it? She breathed. And it worked.
What do you mean? It worked.
Genghis could have had you killed for violating his priority in the hunt. But he didn't. He called me to his yurt. He sent out everybody, even the interpreters. They were just the two of us. I think he really believes now that I am from his Tengri. You know, when I went to him, Genghis had been drinking for hours, so I cured his hangover. I kissed his cup of wine. I slipped in a few aspirins I'd put in my mouth. It was so easy. I tell you, Collier.
What did you offer him, Sable?
What he wants. Long ago he was given a divine mission via a shaman. Genghis is Tengri's representative on Earth, sent to rule over all of us. He knows his mission isn't complete yet, and since the discontinuity he's actually gone backward. But he also knows he's getting older. That communist monument recording the date of his death spooked the bejesus out of him. He wants time to complete his mission. He wants immortality. And that's what I offered him. I told him that in Babylon he will find the philosopher's stone.
Collier gasped. You're crazy.
How do you know, Collier? We've no idea what waits for us in Babylon. Who knows what's possible? And who is to stop us? She sneered. Casey? Those dumbass Brits in India?
Kolya hesitated. Did Genghis take you to his bed?
She smiled. I knew he would be put off by clean flesh, so I took a little dung from his favorite horse and rubbed it in my scalp. I even rolled around in the dirt a bit. It worked. And you know, he liked my skin. The smoothness. The absence of disease scars. He may not like hygiene, but he likes its results.
Her face darkened.
He took me from behind. The Mongols make love about as subtly as they wage war. Someday that hard-faced bastard will pay for that.
Sable.
But not today. He got what he wanted, and so did I.
She beckoned Basil.
You, Frenchy, tell Ye Liu that Genghis has decided. The Mongols would have reached Iraq anyhow in a generation or so. The campaign won't be a challenge for them. The Kurultai, the Council of War, has already been called.
She took a dagger from her boot and thrust it into the map where she had placed it before, into Babylon. This time, nobody dared remove it. Part 4. The Confluence of History. 25. The Fleet. Bicester thought that Alexander's fleet gathered offshore looked magnificent despite the rain. There were triremes with their banks of oars, horses whinnied nervously on flat-bottomed barges, and most impressive of all were the Zoruks, shallow-draft grain lighters, an Indian design that would persist to the 21st century. The rain fell in sheets, obscuring everything, washing out colors and softening lines and perspectives. But it was hot, and the oarsmen went naked, their brown, wiry bodies glistening, the water plastering their hair flat and running down their faces. Bicester couldn't resist taking snaps of the spectacle. But the phone was complaining. What do you think this is, a theme park? You're going to fill my memory long before we get to Babylon. And then what will you do? And I'm getting wet. Alexander, meanwhile, was seeking the gods' approval of the coming journey. Standing at the bow of his ship, he poured libations from a golden bowl into the water and called on Poseidon, the sea nymphs, and the spirits of the world ocean to preserve and protect his fleet. Then he went on to make offerings to Heracles, who he supposed was his ancestor, and Ammon, the Egyptian god he had come to identify with Zeus, and indeed had discovered to be his own father at a shrine in the desert. The few hundred 19th-century British troops, drawn up in rough order by their officers, watched with amazement, and some ribald comments, as the king did his divine duty. But Tommies and sepoys alike had been happy enough to accept the hospitality of the Macedonian camp. Alexander's gestures today were the finale of days of sacrifices and celebration, of musical festivals and athletic contests. Last night the king had given a sacrificial animal, a sheep, cow, or goat, to each platoon. It had been, Bicester thought, like the mightiest barbecue in history. Ruddy Kipling, standing with his broad face sheltered by a peaked cap, pulled irritably at his mustache. What nonsense fills the minds of men! You know, as a child, my ayah was a Roman Catholic who would take us children to church, the one by the botanical gardens in Parle, if you know it. I liked the solemnity and dignity of it all. But then we had a bearer called Mita who would teach us local songs and take us to Hindu temples. I rather liked their dimly seen but friendly gods. Abdikadir said dryly, an interestingly ecumenical childhood. Perhaps, Ruddy said. But stories told to children are one thing, and the ludicrous Hindu pantheon is little more than that. Monstrous and inane, and littered with obscene phallic images. And what is it but a remote echo of this nonsensical crew on whom Alexander wastes good wine, indeed of whom he believes himself to be a part?
Buddy, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, Josh said.
Buddy clapped him on the back.
But chum, hereabouts Rome probably hasn't been built. So what am I to do, eh? Eh?
The ceremonies finished at last. Bicester and the others made for the boats that would transfer them to the ships. They and most of the British troops were to sail with the fleets, with about half of Alexander's army, while the rump would follow the shore. The army camp broke up, and the baggage train began to form. It was a chaotic scene, with thousands of men, women, children, ponies, mules, bullocks, goats, and sheep all milling around. There were carts laden with goods and tools for the cooks, carpenters, cobblers, armorers, and other craftsmen and traders who followed the army. More enigmatic shapes of wood and iron were catapults and siege engines, broken down into kit form. Prostitutes and water carriers worked the crowd, and Bezessa saw the proud heads of camels lifting above the crush. The noise was extraordinary, a clamor of voices, bells, and trumpets, and the complaints of draft animals. The presence of the bewildered man-apes confined in a lashed-up cage on their own cart only added to the circus-like atmosphere of the whole venture. The moderns marveled.
"What a gaggle-fuck," Casey said. "I have never seen anything like it in my life."
But it was all somehow coming together. The coxes began to shout, and oars splashed in the water. And on land and on the sea, Alexander's followers began to join in rhythmic songs. Abdikadir said, "The songs of Sindhi, a magnificent sound. Tens of thousands of voices united."
"Come on," Casey said. "Let's get aboard before those sepoys grab the best deck chairs."
The plan was that the fleet would sail west across the Arabian Sea and then into the Persian Gulf, while the army and baggage train would track its movements following the southern coasts of Pakistan and Iran. They would meet again at the head of the Gulf, and after that, they would strike overland to Babylon. These parallel journeys were necessary. Alexander's boats could not last more than a few days at sea without provisioning from the land. But on land, the going was difficult. The peculiar volcanic rain continued with barely a break, and the sky was a lid of ash-gray cloud. The ground turned to mud, bogging down the carts, animals, and humans alike, and the heat remained intense, the humidity extraordinary. The baggage train was soon strung out over kilometers, a chain of suffering, and in its wake it left behind the corpses of broken animals, irreparable bits of equipment, and after only a few days, people. Casey couldn't bear the sight of Indian women who had to walk behind the carts or the camels with great heaps of goods piled up on their heads. As Ruddy remarked, "Have you noticed how these Iron Age chaps lack so much? Not just the obvious, like gaslights and typewriters and trousers, but blindingly simple things like cart-horse collars. I suppose it's just that nobody's thought of it yet, and once it's invented, it stays invented." That observation struck Casey. After a few days, he sketched a crude wheelbarrow and went to Alexander's advisors with it. Hephaestion would not consider his proposal, and even Eumenes was skeptical, until Casey put together a hasty, toy-sized prototype to demonstrate the idea. After that, at the next overnight stop, Eumenes ordered the construction of as many wheelbarrows as could be managed. There was little fresh wood to be had, but the timber from one foundered barge was scavenged and reused. In that first night under Casey's direction, the carpenters put together more than 50 serviceable barrows. And the next night, having learned from the mistakes of the first batch, nearly 100. But then this was an army that had managed to build a whole fleet for itself on the banks of the Indus. Compared to that, knocking together a few wheelbarrows wasn't such a trick. For the first couple of days after that, the train happened to pass over hard, stony ground, and the barrows worked well. It was quite a sight to see the women of Alexander's baggage train happily pushing along barrows that might have come from a garden center in Middle England, laden with goods, and with children balancing precariously on top. But after that, the mud returned, and the barrows bogged down. The Macedonians soon abandoned them, amid much derision of the moderns' newfangled technology. Every 3 days or so, the ships had to put into shore for provisioning. The shore-based troops were expected to live off the land, providing for themselves and for the crews and passengers of the ships. That became increasingly difficult away from the Indus Delta, as the land grew more barren. So the sailors would vary their rations with the contents of tidal pools, razor clams, oysters, and sometimes mussels. Once, as Bezessa took part in one of these enjoyable scavenging expeditions, a whale broke the surface of the water, its blowhole plume erupting perilously close to some of the anchored ships. At first the Macedonians were terrified, though the Indians laughed. A troop of foot soldiers ran into the sea, yelling and hammering at the water with their shields and spears and the flats of their swords. The next time the whale surfaced, it was 100 meters further away from shore, and it was not seen again. Where the army passed, its scouts surveyed the land and made maps, as Alexander's army had always done. Map-making had also been a crucial tool for the British in establishing and holding their own empire. And now the Greek and Macedonian scouts were joined by British cartographers armed with theodolites. Everywhere they went, they drew new maps and compared them with the old, from before the discontinuity. They encountered few people, however. Once the army scouts found a crowd of around 100, men, women, and children, they said, dressed in strange, bright clothes that were nevertheless falling to rags. They were dying of thirst, and they spoke in a tongue none of the Macedonians could recognize. None of the British or Bessesse's party got a first-hand glimpse of this crowd. Abdi Kadir speculated that they could have come from a hotel from the 20th or even 21st centuries. Cut off when their home vanished into the corridors of time and left to wander, such refugees were like negative image ruins, Bessesse thought. In a normally flowing history, the people would vanish and leave their city slowly to decay into the sand. Here it was the other way round. Alexander's troops, ordered to protect the baggage train, had killed a couple of refugees as an example and driven the rest off. If people were rare, the eyes were a continual presence. As they worked along the coast, they found eyes hovering like lamps along the shoreline, one every few kilometers, and in a loose array covering the interior. Most people ignored them, but Bessesse remained queasily fascinated by the eyes. If an eye had popped into existence in the old world, if it had come to hover over that old favorite of UFO dreamers, the White House lawn, it would have been an extraordinary event, the sensation of the century. But most people didn't even want to talk about it. Eumenes was a notable exception. He would stare at the eyes, hands on hips, as if challenging them to respond. Despite the attrition of the march, Ruddy's spirits seemed to rise as the days passed. He wrote when he could in a tiny, crabbed, paper-preserving hand, and he speculated on the state of the world, expounding to whoever would listen. "We should not stop at Babylon," he said. He, Bessesse, Abdi Kadir, Josh, Casey, and Cecil de Morgan were sitting under the awning of an officer's ship. The rain rattled on the awning and hissed on the surface of the sea. "We should go on. Explore Judea, for example. Think about it, Bessesse. The ethereal eye of your space boat could make out only scattered settlements there, a few threads of smoke. What if, in one of those mean huts, even now the Nazarene is taking his first lusty breath? Why, we would be like 10,000 magi, following a strange star." "And then there is Mecca," Abdi Kadir said dryly. Ruddy spread his hands expansively. "Let's be ecumenical about it." Bessesse asked, "So, after your complicated origins, you've ended up a Christian, Ruddy?" He stroked his mustache. "Put it this way. Believe in God. Not sure about the Trinity. Can't accept eternal damnation. But there must be some retribution." He smiled. "I sound like a Methodist. My father would be pleased. Anyhow, I'd be delighted to meet the chap who started it all." But Josh said, "Be careful what you wish for, Ruddy. This is not some vast museum through which we travel. Perhaps you would find Christ in Judea. But what if not? It's unlikely, after all. In fact, it's far more likely that all of the Judea we find here has been ripped out of a time before Christ's birth." "I was born after the Incarnation," Ruddy said firmly. "There is no doubt about that. And if I could summon up one grandfather after another in a great chain of predecessors, I could have them attest to that fact." "Yes," said Josh, "but you are not in the history of your grandfathers any more, Ruddy. What if there has been no incarnation here? And you are a saved man in a pagan world. Are you Virgil or Dante?" Ruddy fell silent, his broad brow furrowed. "It would take a better theologian than I to puzzle that out. Let's add it to the itinerary. We must seek Augustine or Aquinas and ask them what they think. And what about you, Abdi Kadir? What if there is no Mecca? What if Muhammad has yet to be born?" Abdi Kadir said, "Islam is not time-bound as Christianity is. Tawhid, unicity, remains true. On Mir as on earth, in the past as in the future, there is no God but God. That every particle of the universe, every leaf on every tree, is an expression of his immanence."
And the Quran is the unmediated word of God. In this world as in any other, whether his prophet exists here to speak it or not. Josh nodded. It's a comforting point of view. As-salamu alaykum, said Abdikadir.
Anyhow, it may even be more complicated than that, the assessor said. Mir didn't come from one time frame, remember? It is a patchwork, and that surely applies in Mecca and Judea. Perhaps there are bits of Judea dating from before Christ's birth, but bits later, where he once walked. So does the incarnation apply to this universe or not?
Ruddy said, how strange it is. We are each granted 25,000 days of our lives, say. Is it possible that we, too, are fragmented? That each day has been cut out of our lives like a square from a quilt?
He waved a hand at the ash-gray sky.
Is it possible? There are 25,000 other Ruddies out there somewhere, each picking up his life where he can.
One of you mouthy assholes is enough for me, Casey growled, his first contribution to the debate, and he took a pull from his skin of watered-down wine. Cecil de Morgan listened to such talk mostly silently. The assessor knew he had formed a loose alliance with Alexander's Greek secretary, Eumenes, and de Morgan reported back such speculations to his new partner. They were both in it for themselves, of course. Eumenes' priority was his own jostling with Alexander's other courtiers, notably Hephaestion. And Cecil was, as always, playing both ends against the middle. But everybody knew that, and Vesessa saw no harm in information flowing through Cecil to Eumenes. They were all in this together, after all. The fleet sailed on. 26. The Temple. When Mongols broke camp, the first task was to round up horses. Mongol horses lived semi-wild, in herds that were allowed to roam around the plains until needed. There had been some concern that the time slips might have magicked away many of the herds Genghis Khan's plans relied on. But riders were sent out into the field to bring them in, and after a day, great clouds of horses came thundering across the plain toward the metropolis of Yurts. The men closed around the horses, brandishing long poles with lassos on the end. As if they knew that a march of thousands of kilometers lay ahead of them, the horses bucked and darted defiantly. But once bound, they allowed themselves to be led away stoically. Kolya thought it was typical of the Mongols' whole uncivilized enterprise that even the greatest campaign should have to start with a rodeo. After the spectacle of the roundup, the preparations for the march were rapid. Most of the yurts were collapsed and loaded onto carts or baggage animals, but some of the larger tents, including those that had made up Genghis's pavilion, were loaded onto broad-based carts drawn by teams of oxen. Even the Soyuz capsule was to be dragged along. It had been brought here at Genghis's orders from the village of Skakatai. Kolya understood that a siege engine had been adapted to lift it. Sitting on a heavy-duty cart, strapped on by horsehair ropes, it looked like a metal yurt itself. For his march on Babylon, Kolya estimated that Genghis Khan would be accompanied by around 20,000 warriors, most of them cavalrymen, and each of these accompanied by at least one attendant and two or three spare horses. Genghis organized his traveling force into three divisions, armies of the left wing and of the right and of the center. The center, commanded by Genghis Khan himself, included the elite imperial guard, including Genghis's own thousand-strong bodyguard. Sable and Kolya would travel with the center in the retinue of Yedu. Some forces were left behind to garrison Mongolia itself and to continue the task of piecing together what had become of the empire. The garrison would be left under the command of one of Genghis Khan's sons, Tolui. Genghis Khan was not significantly weakened by leaving Tolui behind. As well as his chancellor Yelu, he had with him another son, Ogode, and his general, Sabade. Considering that Ogode was the man who would have succeeded Genghis Khan in the old timeline, and that Sibade was perhaps Genghis's most able general, the man who would have masterminded the invasion of Europe after Genghis's death, it was a formidable team indeed. Kolya witnessed the moment when Genghis Khan took leave of his son. Genghis drew Tolui's face to his own with his two hands and touched his lips to one of Tolui's cheeks, inhaling deeply. Sable dismissed it as an Iron Age air kiss, but Kolya was oddly moved. At last Genghis's standard was raised, and with a clamor of shouts, trumpets, and drums, the force set off, followed by long baggage trains. The three columns, under the command of Genghis, Ogoday, and Sabutai, were to travel independently, perhaps diverging hundreds of kilometers from each other, but they would keep in touch daily through fast riders, trumpet blasts, and smoke signals. Soon the great clouds of kicked-up dust were separating across the plains of Mongolia, and by the second day the forces were out of each other's sight. Traveling west from the region of Genghis Khan's birthplace, they followed a tributary of the Onon River through a country of rich meadows. Kolya rode in a cart with Sable, Basil, and other subdued-looking foreign traders, and some of Yelu's staff. After the first couple of days, they entered a country of gloomy, somewhat sinister forests, broken by boggy valleys that were frequently difficult to ford. The skies remained leaden, and the rain beat down. Kolya felt oppressed in this dismal, gloomy place. He warned Yelu about acid rain, and the administrator passed on orders that the soldiers should ride with their caps on and collars raised on their coats. Genghis's troops were no more hygienic than the common Mongols, but they took pride in their appearance. They rode on saddles high at the back and front with solid stirrups. They wore conical felt caps lined with fur from fox, wolf, or even lynx, and long robe-like coats that opened from top to bottom. The Mongols had worn such garments since time immemorial. But these were a wealthy people now, and some of the officers wore coats embroidered with silk or gold thread and silken underwear from China. But even Genghis's generals would wipe their mouths on their sleeves and their hands on their trousers. The Mongols' field craft was slick and practiced, but then it was the product of centuries of tradition. The march was broken each night and rations distributed. Dried milk curd, millet meal, kumis, an alcoholic drink made from fermented milk curd, and cured meat. In the morning, a rider would put a bit of dried curd and water into a leather bag, and the shaking as he rode along would soon turn it into a kind of yogurt, consumed with great relish and much belching. Kolya envied the Mongols' skills. How they made rawhide from cow skin, even how they used a distillate of human urine as a purgative when one man had a fever. Genghis's army moved efficiently, and orders and changes of plan were transmitted rapidly and without confusion. The army was rigidly governed by a hierarchy based on rules of 10. That way, the chain of command was simplified, with each officer having no more than 10 subordinates. The Mongols empowered their local commanders as much as possible, which enhanced the army's flexibility and responsiveness. And Genghis made sure that all units of his army, down to the poorest platoon, was made up of a mix of nationalities, clans, and tribes. He wanted nobody to have any loyalty save to the Khan himself. It was, Kolya thought, a remarkably modern way of structuring an army. No wonder these Mongols had overwhelmed the ragbag forces of medieval Europe. But the system relied heavily on efficient and loyal staff. The officer corps was ruthlessly weeded out in training through such tests as the battue, and, of course, in battle. After a few days, still deep in the heart of Mongolia, the army crossed a grassy plain toward Karakoram. This city had once been the power center of the Uyghurs, and Genghis Khan had established it as his own permanent seat of power. But even from a distance, Kolya could see the city's walls were ruined. Inside the walls, a few abandoned temples huddled in one corner, but the rest of the city had been conquered by the eternal grass. Genghis Khan himself, accompanied by burly guards, stalked with Ogoday around this place. To Genghis, it was only a few years since he had established the city, and now here it was, eroded to rubble. Kolya saw him return to his traveling yurt, his face like thunder, as if he was angry with the very gods who would make such a mockery of his ambitions. In the days that followed, the army passed through the valley of the Orkhon River, an immense walled plain bounded to the east by blue mountains. It was almost like a Martian valley, Kolya thought idly. The earth here was gray and flaking, the river languid. Sometimes they had to ford tributaries and river channels. At night they camped on islands of bare mud and made huge aromatic fires of dead willow wood. They crossed one last river, and the country began to rise. Sable said they were leaving the modern Mongolian province of Arhangai and crossing the Hangai Massif. Behind Kolya, the country folded up into a complex patchwork of forests and valleys.
But beyond the massif, he could see a more elemental landscape of yellow grassland stretching away. At the massif's broad summit, there were many small ridges and folds littered by shattered pebbles, as if many time slices had crisscrossed. But a cairn stood here, a heap of stones that had somehow survived the time shocks. As the army passed, each man added a pebble or rock to the cairn. Collier saw that by the time they had all gone by, it would be a mighty mound. They descended at last to the step. The massif receded over the horizon, leaving nothing but flatness, and they walked across a treeless plain where the long grass rippled around the horses like parting water. As the world opened up around him, the immense scale of Central Asia at last diminishing even Genghis Khan and his ambitions, Collier felt a huge relief. But they encountered no people. In this huge place, there could sometimes be seen the circular shadows of yurts, the scars of fires, the ghosts of small villages packed up and moved on to another pasture. The steppe was timeless. People always lived here much the same way. And these scars could have been made by Huns, Mongols, or even Soviet-era communists. And those who left these shadows might have walked across the plain and into another time entirely. Maybe, Collier thought, when the last shreds of civilization wore away, when the earth was forgotten and nothing was left but mere, they would all become nomads, drawn into this great pit of human destiny. But no people. Sometimes Genghis would send out search parties, but nobody was found. Then, lost in the middle of the steppe, the scouts unexpectedly came upon a temple. A party was sent ahead to investigate. Yedu included Collier and Sable, hoping that their perspective might be of use. The temple was a small box-like building with tall doors, ornately carved and decorated with lion-head knockers. Out front was a porch framed by lacquered pillars, and the beams at the top were decorated by gold skulls. Collier, Sable, and some of the Mongols stepped cautiously inside. On low tables, manuscript rolls had been set out amid the debris of a meal. The walls were wooden, the air full of strong incense, and the feeling of enclosure was powerful. Collier found himself whispering, "Buddhists, you think?" Sable had no qualms about raising her voice.
"Yes, and at least some of them are still around. No telling when this place is from. Buddhists are as timeless as nomads."
"Not quite," Collier said grimly.
"The Soviets tried to purge Mongolia of the temples. This place must predate the 20th century.
Two figures came shuffling forward from the shadows at the back of the temple. The Mongol soldiers drew their daggers to be stopped by a sharp word from Yelu's advisor. At first, Collier thought they were two children. They seemed so similar in size and build. But as they came into the light, he saw that one of them was indeed a child, but the other an old man. The old one, evidently a lama, wore a red satin robe and slippers, and he carried a string of amber prayer beads. He was astonishingly thin, his wrists protruding from his sleeves like the bones of a bird. The child was a boy, no older than 10, as tall as the old one and nearly as skinny. He wore some kind of red robe, too, but on his feet were sneakers, Collier noted with a start. The lama had one skinny arm wrapped around the boy, but the lama was so frail his weight could have been no burden even to a child. The lama grinned, showing an almost toothless mouth, and began to speak in a rustling voice. The Mongols tried to reply, but it was soon obvious there was no point of contact. Collier whispered to Sable,
"Look at the boy's shoes. Maybe this place is more recent than we think."
Sable grunted. "The shoes are recent. Proves nothing. If these two have been left alone here, the kid must have been out foraging."
"The llama's so old," Collier whispered.
So he was. His skin looked paper thin, and stained by age, hung in gentle folds from his bones. And his eyes were a blue so pale they almost seemed transparent. It was as if he had sublimated with age. His substance just evaporated away.
"Yeah," said Sable. 90 if he's a day. "But look at the two of them, Cole. Put aside the age gap. Look at their eyes, the bone structure, the chin."
Collier stared, wishing the light were brighter. The shape of the boy's skull was hidden by a mop of black hair, but his face, his pale blue eyes, they look alike.
"So they do," Sable said dryly. "Collier, when you come to a place like this, it's for life.
You arrive as a cadet at 8 or 9. You stay here and chant and pray. And you're still at it when you're 90, if you live that long.
Sable,
these two are one. The same man, the youthful cadet, the aged lama, brought together by faults in time. And the boy knows that when he grows old, he will one day see his own younger self come walking across the step. She grinned. They don't seem phased, do they? Maybe Buddhist philosophy doesn't have to be stretched too far to accommodate what's happened. It's just a circle closing, after all.
The Mongol soldiers searched desultorily for plunder, but there was nothing to be had save for a few scraps of food and the petty treasures of worship, prayer wheels, sacred texts. The Mongols made to kill the monks. They prepared for this without emotion, just a matter of routine. Killing was what they did. Kolya plucked up his courage and interceded with Yelü's advisor to stop this. They left the temple to its paradoxical slumber, and the army moved on. 27. The Fish Eaters. After 3 weeks of the journey along the coast of the Gulf, Eumenes let the moderns know that the scouts had found an inhabited village. Driven by curiosity and a need for a break from the sea, Bisessa, Abdikadir, Josh, Ruddy, and a small squad of British soldiers under Corporal Batson joined an advance party at the head of the sprawling train that Alexander's army had become. All the moderns were discreetly equipped with firearms. As they disembarked, Casey, his legs still weak, watched from the boats with envy. It was a day's walk to the village, and it was a tough slog. Though Ruddy was the first to grumble, they were all soon suffering. If they walked too close to the shore, there was nothing but salt and stony ground where nothing grew. But if they went inland, they hit sand dunes over which the going would have been tough even without the rain. There was always a danger of flash floods as water came pouring down overloaded courses. And when the rain stopped falling, the horseflies would rise up like clouds. Snakes were a constant hazard. None of the moderns was able to recognize the varieties they encountered here, but as they might have been drawn from a line of descent that spanned 2 million years or more, perhaps that wasn't surprising. Isessa glared at the unmoving eyes, effortlessly placed over the most difficult country, which watched her petty struggles as she passed. At the end of the day, the party came to the village. With the Macedonian soldiers, Bisessa and the others crept up the crest of a bluff to see. Close to the shore, it was a poor-looking place. Round-shouldered huts sat squat on the stony ground. A few scrawny sheep grazed the scrubby grass behind the village. The natives weren't prepossessing. Adults and children alike had long, matted, filthy hair, and the men trailed beards. Their main source of nourishment was fish, which they caught by wading into the water and casting nets made of palm bark. They went about their business dressed crudely in what looked like the treated skin of fish, or maybe even whale. Ruddy said, "They are clearly human, but they are Stone Age." De Morgan said, "But they may have come from a time not much before now. I mean Alexander's era. One of the Macedonians has seen people like this before. He calls them fish eaters." Abdikadir nodded. "We tend to forget how empty Alexander's world was. A couple of thousand kilometers away, you have the Greece of Aristotle. But here, you have Neolithics, living as they have since the Ice Age, perhaps." The Sessa said, "And perhaps this new world won't seem so strange to the Macedonians as it does to us." The Macedonians treated the fish-eaters briskly, driving them off with a volley of arrows. Then the advance party marched into the deserted village. Bisessa looked around curiously. The stink of fish permeated everything. She found a kind of knife on the ground, made of bone, perhaps the scapula of a small whale or dolphin. It had been finely carved, and dolphins danced over its surface. Josh inspected the huts. "Look at this. The huts are just skins thrown over frames of whale bones, or, look here, banks of heaped-up oyster shells. Almost everything they have they get from the sea. Even their clothes, tools, and homes. Remarkable." As an example of living archaeology, Bisessa thought, this was an unimaginably rich place, and she recorded as much as she could, despite the phone's bleating. But she felt depressed at how much of the past was lost and forever unknowable. This shard of a vanished way of life, torn out of its context, was just another page ripped out of an untitled book, salvaged from a vanished library. The soldiers were here for provision, not archaeology. But there was little here for them. A store of powdered fish meal was dug up and taken away. A few wretched sheep were captured and quickly slaughtered. But even their meat turned out to taste dreadfully of fish and salt. Bisessa was dismayed at this casual destruction of the village, but there was nothing she could do about it. A single eye hovered over the village of the fish-eaters. It watched the Macedonians leave as it had watched them come, with no reaction. They spent the night not far from the village, close to a stream. The Macedonians set up camp with their customary efficiency, stretching some of their leather tents out on poles as a rough awning to keep off the rain. The British soldiers helped with the work. Bisessa decided it was time for some proper admin. The toilet facilities on Alexander's ships weren't exactly advanced. The relief at getting her boots off was huge. Briskly, she treated her feet. Her socks crackled with sweat and dust, and the gaps between her toes were caked with dirt and what looked like the beginnings of athlete's foot. She was sparing with what was left of her medical kit, which was, after all, just a small emergency pack, though out in the field like this, she continued to use her Puritans. She stripped and dunked herself in the cold water of the stream. She wasn't too concerned by the attentions of her male companions. Lusts were slaked easily enough in the Macedonian camp. Josh watched her, of course, as he always did, but boyishly, and if she caught him, he would duck his head and blush. She rinsed out her clothes and left them to dry. By the time she was done, the Macedonians had built a fire. She lay down on the ground close to the fire, slipped under her poncho, and set her pack as a pillow beneath her head. Josh, as always, maneuvered himself closest to her, and settled into a position where he could just stare at her when he thought nobody was looking. But behind his back, Ruddy and Abdelkadir mimed blowing kisses. Ruddy started holding forth, as he always did. "We are so few. We've seen a great swath of the New World now, from Jamrud to the coast of Arabia. Humans are spread thin, and thinking humans thinner. But we keep seeing the emptiness of the land as an absence. We should regard it rather as an opportunity." Josh murmured, "What are you on about, Giggers?" Ruddy Kipling took off his spectacles and rubbed eyes that looked small and deep. "Our English Empire is gone now, wiped away like a bridge suit in a card shuffle. Instead, we have this. Mere, a new world, a blank canvas. And we few, might be the only source of rationality and science and civilization left in the world." Abdelkadir smiled. "Fair enough, Ruddy. But there aren't too many Englishmen here on Mir to translate that dream into reality." "But an Englishman always was a mongrel, and that's not a bad thing. He's the sum of his influences, from the solemn might of the Romans to the fierce intelligence of democracy. Well, then, we must start to build a new England and forge new Englishmen right here on the sands of Arabia. And we can found our new state from the beginning on solid English principles. Every man absolutely independent, so long as he doesn't infringe his neighbor's rights. Prompt and equal justice before God. Toleration of religions and creeds of any shape or form. Every man's home is castle. That sort of thing. It's an opportunity to clear out a lot of clutter."
"That all sounds marvelous," said Abdelkadir. "But who's to run the New World Empire? Shall we leave it to Alexander?"
Ruddy laughed.
"Alexander achieved marvelous things for his time, but he is a military despot. Worse, an Iron Age savage. You saw that display of idol bothering by the sea. Perhaps he had the right instincts buried under his armor. He did cart along the Greeks, but he's not the chap. For the time being, we civilized folk must guide. We are few, but we have the weapons."
Ruddy lay back, arm behind his head, and closed his eyes.
"I can see it now. The forges will ring out. The sword will bring peace. And peace will bring wealth. And wealth will bring the law. It's as natural as the growth of a sturdy oak. And we, who have seen it all before, will be there to water the sapling."
He meant to inspire them, but his words seemed hollow to Bisessa, and their camp seemed a small and isolated place, a speck of light in a land empty even of ghosts. The next day, during the walk back, Ruddy took ill with a severe dose of gut infection.
Assessor and Abdikadir dug into their dwindling 21st century medical packs to give him antibiotics and made up drinks of sugar and water. Ruddy asked for his opium, insisting it was one of the oldest analgesics in the Indian pharmacopoeia. Still, the diarrhea weakened him, and his broad head looked too heavy on his neck, but he talked and talked.
"We need a new set of myths to bind us," Ruddy wheezed. "Myths and rituals, that's what makes a nation. That's what America lacks, you know. A young nation, no time yet to grow tradition. Well, America is gone now, and Britain too. And the old stories won't do. Not anymore."
Josh said wryly, "You're just the man to write new ones, Ruddy."
"We are living in a new age of heroes," he said. "This is the age when the world is built. That's our opportunity. And we must tell the future what we did, how we did it, and why."
On Ruddy talked, filling the air with his dreams and plans, until dehydration and breathlessness forced him to stop, and they walked slowly on through the huge, empty desert. 28. Bishkek. The army of Genghis Khan skirted the northern edge of the Gobi Desert. The land was vast, a mirror of the dust-clogged sky. Sometimes they would see eroded, tired-looking hills, and once a herd of camels trotted by in the distance, stiff-backed and pompous. When the wind blew, a storm of yellow sand blocked out the light, sand that tasted of iron, sand that might have been formed a million years ago, Kolya thought, or a month. The Mongols, their heads wrapped in cloth, looked like Bedouins. As the desert crossing wore on, Kolya sank within himself. His mind numbed, his senses dulled. He would sit in the back of the cart, never speaking, a cloth drawn across his face to keep out the dust. The land was so huge and still that sometimes it was as if they weren't moving at all. He grudgingly admired the strength of spirit, the sheer bloody-minded resilience that enabled the Mongols to conquer the immense distances of their Asiatic stage. And yet he had flown in space, and once he would have spanned the distance he had traveled so vast on the human scale in 15 minutes or less. They came to a great mound of stone and earth, a barrow. It looked like some trapped faunic beast struggling to escape the clutches of the bone-dry ground. Kolya thought this was a Scythian tomb, a relic of a people who had lived before the birth of Christ, but who had ridden horses and built yurts just like the Mongols. The mound looked fresh, the stones unworn, but the tomb had been broken open, robbed of whatever gold or other wealth it had contained. And then they came to an almost modern relic. Kolya glimpsed it only from the distance. Tin-roofed cement barns, silos, what looked like a convoy of rusted tractors. Perhaps it was a government agricultural project, abandoned apparently long before the discontinuity. Perhaps as they moved away from central Mongolia, Kolya mused, they were leaving behind the center of gravity of this vast continent's history, the terrible reign of Genghis Khan. Perhaps here the shards of shattered time had been more free to settle as they willed, bearing refugees from wider expanses. The Mongol scouts inspected the site, pulled around a few sheets of rusted corrugated iron, abandoned it as worthless. Slowly the country changed. They passed a lake, dry, a sheet of salt. At its edge, lizards hopped between the rocks, and flies rose up, troubling the horses. Kolya was startled to hear the desolate cries of seabirds, for they could scarcely be a place in the world further from the sea than this desiccated heartland. Perhaps the birds had followed Asia's complicated network of rivers and become lost here. The parallel with his own situation was obvious, the irony banal. And still the journey wore on. To leave modern Mongolia, they would have to pass through a range called the Altai Mountains. Day by day, the ground rose, becoming more fertile and better watered. In places, there were even flowers. Once Kolya found primulas, anemones, orchids, stranded on a dying fragment of steppe spring. They crossed a wide marshy plain where plovers wheeled over sodden grass, and the horses plodded carefully through murk that rose to their ankles. The ground became mountainous. The army squeezed through valleys, each higher and more narrow than the one before. The Mongols called to each other, and their voices echoed from the walls. Sometimes Kolya would see eagles high above, their unmistakable silhouettes painted against the lead-gray sky. Genghis's generals muttered darkly about their vulnerability to ambush here.
At last the land opened up into a vast canyon bounded by walls of shattered rock that reared up toward the sky. Collier found himself on the ridge at the head of the canyon. An enormous flat-topped mountain loomed over him, streaked by snow and ice like the droppings of immense birds. He looked back and saw the army of Genghis Khan strung out along the canyon's length, people and animals the color of mud, with here and there the sparkle of polished armor. But this thin line of people was dwarfed by the towering pinnacles of purple-red rock around them. They moved on, tracking the northwestern border of modern China, heading southwest toward Kyrgyzstan. After that, it was only a few more days' ride until they came to the town. The Mongols, great believers in intelligence, sent scouts and spies creeping around the town, and eventually envoys who walked boldly up its main streets. Citizens in flat caps and buttoned-up jackets marched out, hands extended in friendship to these rank-smelling strangers. The place was obviously modern, or nearly so. The news of it seemed to jolt Kolya out of the trance into which the journey had plunged him. It was a shock when he heard that the army and he had been traveling for nearly 3 months. And it was here, as it turned out, that the final stage of his own journey would begin. Sable was taken forward to help check out the town. It was Bishkek, she thought, in the 21st century, the capital of Kyrgyzstan. The place, as they had found it, was obviously from some pre-electric age, where there were water mills and factories. It could be late 19th century, she said. Metal roads led into the town, but they were truncated by time slips a kilometer or so outside town. More scouts were sent in, and Kolya was taken to translate. The town was a pretty place, its streets lined with trees, wilting a little under the persistent acid rain. Reflecting a deeper history, its main thoroughfare was called Silk Road Street. The townsfolk, cut off and with no idea what had happened, were disturbed by the lack of visits by their tax inspectors, and wanted to know if there were any directives from Moscow, any news of the Tsar. Kolya longed to speak directly to them, but the Mongols wouldn't allow it. Kolya was excited by the town, the most modern place they had yet encountered. Surely there was a base of equipment and expertise here that could be built on. He pressed Yelu to make friendly contact, but his pleas went unheard, and he began to grow disturbed. The Mongols did not like towns and knew only one way to deal with them. Sable wouldn't back him up. She merely watched and waited, playing her own complicated game. Kolya witnessed some of what followed. The Mongols came in the night, riding in silence. When they charged, they roared, and the sound of their voices and the horses' hooves overwhelmed the little town. The killing began in the main street and swept through the town, a wave of butchery with a bloody froth of slaughter at its leading edge. The townsfolk could put up no resistance, save for a few futile potshots with antiquated firearms. Genghis had ordered that the town's ruler be brought out alive. The mayor tried to hide himself and his family in the town's small library, and the building was taken apart brick by brick. His wife was killed before him, his daughters raped, and the man himself trampled to death. The Mongols found little of value in the town. They broke up the newspaper office's small printing press, bringing out the iron to melt down and reuse. It was the Mongols' habit when taking a town to pick out artisans and other skilled folk who might serve their purposes later. But in Bishkek, they were capable of recognizing little of what they found. The skills of a clockmaker or accountant or lawyer meant nothing to them. Few men were allowed to live. Most of the children and some of the younger women were taken prisoner, though many of the women were raped. All this was done mechanically, joylessly, even the rapes. It was just what the Mongols did. When they were done, the Mongols torched the town systematically. The surviving prisoners were driven out into the countryside towards Genghis's encampment, where they huddled in desolate misery. To Kolya, they looked like classic peasant stock, and their waistcoats and trousers, thick skirts and headscarves, were the subject of stares from the Mongols. One beauty called Natasha, the 15-year-old daughter of an innkeeper, was picked out for Genghis himself. He always took the most beautiful women, and impregnated many of them. Genghis had intended to drive the prisoners on with him, for there were always uses for such wretched souls. They could be driven into battle, for instance. And when he found that one of the golden family had been injured by the bullet of a wild-eyed solicitor, he ordered the prisoners to be slain.
Elu's weary pleas for leniency counted for nothing. The women and children submitted meekly. By the time the army moved on, the town was reduced to a smoking ruin, little left of the buildings above foundation level. The Mongols left a heap of severed heads, some of them heartbreakingly tiny. A few days later, Genghis ordered his rear guard to return to the town. A handful of citizens had escaped the slaughter, hiding in cellars and other hideaways. The Mongols rounded these up and put them to death, after enjoying a little more sport. Sable showed no reaction to this, no emotion at all. But as for Kolya, after Bishkek, his mind seemed clear about what he must do. 29. Babylon. It took 2 months of sailing to reach the head of the Gulf. From there, Alexander was anxious to move inland quickly. He formed up an advance party of 1,000 troops, accompanied by Eumenes, Hephaestion, and others. Isessa and her companions made sure they were attached to the expedition. Within a day of disembarking, the party set off for the short march inland to Susa, in Alexander's time, the administrative center of his conquered Persian Empire. Alexander was still too weak to ride or walk far, so he rode on a cart covered with purple awnings, 100 shield-bearers marching in step around him. They reached Susa without incident, but it was not the Susa Alexander remembered. Alexander's surveyors had no doubt about the site, at the heart of a sparsely greened plain. But there was no sign of the city, none at all. They might have been the first humans ever to set foot here, as perhaps they were, Isessa thought. Eumenes joined the moderns, his face grim. I was here only a few years ago. This was a rich place. Every province of the empire contributed to its magnificence, from craftsmen and silversmiths from the Greek cities of the coast to wooden pillars from India. The treasure here was remarkable. And now... He seemed overcome, and Bessessa glimpsed again the rage she had sensed building in him, as if this intelligent Greek took the discontinuity personally. Alexander himself got out of his cart and walked around, peering at the earth and kicking at clods of dirt. Then he retreated to his awning and refused to emerge again, as if in disgust. They camped that night near the vacant site of Susa. The next morning, guided by Alexander's cartographers, they set off due west, making for Babylon, crossing a vast and echoing land. After Susa, everybody seemed subdued, as if the vast weight of time bore down on them all. Sometimes Bessessa would catch the Macedonians looking at her and sensed what they were thinking, that here was a woman, living and breathing, who would not be born until everybody they knew, everything they had touched, had eroded to dust, as if she was a living symbol of the discontinuity. To everyone's relief, they had not gone many kilometers before they reached a junction in time where the surface of the ground dropped a few centimeters, and a road was revealed. It was crudely laid to Bessessa's eyes, topped with coarsely cut stone blocks, but it was undoubtedly a road. In fact, Eumenes told them, it was a section of the royal road that had once united Persia, and which Alexander had found extraordinarily useful in his conquest of the empire. Even on the road, the march took several more days. The land around the road was dust dry, colonized only by scrub vegetation. But it was marked here and there by anonymous mounds of rubble and scarred by great straight-line ditches, evidently artificial, but long abandoned, their purpose forgotten. Each night when the march broke to make camp, Casey would set up his radio gear and listen for any signals coming from the Soyuz crew, lost somewhere in the unknowable expanses of Asia. It was a time they'd agreed upon with the crew, but he'd heard nothing since the day of their attempted re-entry. Casey also monitored the radio signal that continued to emanate from the unknown beacon that was presumed to lie in Babylon. Its content remained the same, just a chirp, a sweep up through the frequencies like an engineering test signal. But it continued to repeat over and over. Casey kept a log of his observations with position, time, signal strength, and bearings, and his rough triangulations continued to predict a source inside Babylon. And then there were the eyes, or rather the lack of them. As they walked west, the eyes were fewer, more spaced out, until at last Bessessa realized she had marched through a whole day without seeing a single one. Nobody had any idea what to make of this. At last they approached another transition.
The advance party came to a line of green that stretched dead straight from the northern horizon to the south. The party hesitated on the desiccated side of the border. To the west, beyond the line, the land was split up into polygonal fields and striped by glistening canals. Here and there, crude-looking wattle and daub shacks sat amid the fields, squat and ugly, like lumps of shaped mud. The shacks were clearly occupied, for Bezetta could see traces of smoke rising from some of them. A few goats and bullocks, tethered to posts, patiently chewed on grass or stubble. But there were no people. Abdikadir stood with Bezetta. Babylon's famous irrigation canals. I suppose they must be. Some of the canals were extensions of the dry, worn-out ditches she had noticed before. The same bits of ancient engineering, severed by centuries. But this crude coupling of the eras obviously caused practical problems. The sections from later eras, ditches silted up by erosion, blocked off the canals from their riverside sources, and some of the farmers' channels were drying up. Abdikadir said, "Let's show the way." He took a deliberate step forward and crossed the invisible, intangible line between the two world slices. The party crossed the disjunction and moved on. The richness of the land was obvious. Most of the fields seemed to be stocked with wheat, of a tall, fat-headed variety farmer's daughter Bezetta didn't recognize. But there was also millet and barley, and here and there rich stands of date palms. Once Cecil de Morgan said, the Babylonians would sing songs about these palms, listing their 360 uses, one for every day of their year. Whether the farmers were hiding or not, this obviously wasn't an empty landscape, and it was on the produce of these fields that Alexander's army was going to depend. There would have to be some gentle diplomacy here, Bezetta realized. The king had the manpower to take whatever he wanted, but the natives knew the land, and this vast and hungry army couldn't afford a single failed crop. Perhaps the first priority ought to be to get Alexander's soldiers and engineers to rebuild the irrigation system. Abdikadir said, "You know, it's impossible to believe this is Iraq, that we are only 100 kilometers or so southwest of Baghdad. The agricultural wealth of this place fueled empires for millennia." "But where is everybody?" Abdi said, "Can you blame these farmers for hiding? Their rich farmland is sliced in half and replaced by semi-desert. The canals fail. A stinging rain withers their crops. Then what looms over the horizon? Only the greatest army the ancient world ever saw." "Ah," he said. "There." He stopped and pointed. On the western horizon she saw buildings, a complicated wall, a thing like a stepped pyramid, all made gray and misty by distance. "Babylon," Abdikadir whispered. Josh said, "And that is the Tower of Babel." "Holy crap," said Casey. The army and its baggage train caught up with its head and spread out into a camp over the mudflats near the banks of the Euphrates. Alexander chose to wait a day before entering the city itself. He wanted to see if the dignitaries of the city would come out to greet him. Nobody came. He sent out scouts to survey the city walls and its surroundings. They returned safe, but, Bezetta thought, they looked shocked. Time slices or not, Alexander was going to enter the ancient city in the grand style. So, early in the morning, wearing his gold-embroidered cloak and his royal diadem on his head, he rode ahead toward the city walls, with Hephaestion walking at his side, and a phalanx of 100 shield-bearers around him, a rectangle of ferocious muscle and iron. The king showed no sign of the pain the effort to ride must be causing him. Once again, Bezetta was astounded by his strength of will. Eumenes and other close companions walked in a loose formation behind the king. Among this party were Captain Grove and his senior officers, a number of British troops, and Bezetta and the bird crew. Bezetta felt oddly self-conscious in the middle of this grand procession, for she and the other moderns towered over the Macedonians, despite the finery of their dress uniform. The city's walls were impressive enough in themselves, a triple circuit of baked brick and rubble that must have stretched 20 kilometers around, all surrounded by a moat. But there were no signs of life, no smoke from fires, no soldiers watching vigilantly from the towers, and the great gates hung open. Eumenes muttered,
It was different last time on Alexander's first entry to the city. A satrap rode out to meet us. The road was strewn with flowers, and soldiers came out with tame lions and leopards in cages, and priests and prophets danced to the sound of harps. It was magnificent. It was fitting. But this... this, conceded Bisesser, was scary. Alexander, for his reputation, led by example. Without hesitating, he walked his horse over the wooden bridge that spanned the moat and approached the grandest of the gates. This was a high-arched passage set between two heavy square towers.